Les conférences du Collège de France.
Je suis très heureux d'accueillir ce matin Sylvia Laura dans cet espace du Collège de France que vous connaissiez auparavant sous le nom de Salle 5 et qui s'appelle depuis le mois de mars Amphithéâtre Mireille Delmas-Marty en mémoire de notre collègue juriste récemment disparu. Sylvia Laura a étudié l'archéologie et l'ittitologie à l'Université de Florence, où elle a obtenu son doctorat en 1998. Elle a ensuite été postdoctorante à Berlin et elle est actuellement directrice de recherche au CNR à Rome. Et je parlerai surtout du projet Gresso que Sylvia a fondé en 2013, si je ne m'abuse. Donc, il s'agit d'un groupe de recherche interdisciplinaire sur l'histoire des études orientalistes, si je traduis en français le titre italien de Gresso. Et ce groupe réunit de nombreux collègues issus de différentes institutions et il a pour but de retracer à la fois l'histoire des recherches et leur réception à l'époque correspondante. Le projet a notamment mis l'accent sur la découverte et l'exploitation d'archives. Non pas d'archives cunéiformes, mais d'archives des savants qui ont étudié ces sources. Et donc correspondances, mais aussi photos, dessins, cartes, notes de chantier, journaux, etc. Et à partir de ces matériaux, l'idée consiste à reconstituer les processus intellectuels qui ont motivé les chercheurs du passé dans leur démarche scientifique. Alors il s'agit à la fois de mettre l'accent sur des personnalités importantes, sur des institutions clés, et finalement sur les idéologies sous-jacentes. Alors c'est un projet qui a déjà donné lieu à plusieurs livres, dont un superbe ouvrage collectif dans la collection Documenta Asiana que Sylvia Laura dirige à Rome. Et je dois dire que j'ai été personnellement très heureux de m'inspirer de cet esprit lorsque j'ai donné ici mon cours sur l'histoire de la sériologie en France, qui a abouti à plusieurs publications dont mon livre sur qui s'appelle Enquête de Ninive, et puis qui va être prolongé par le colloque sur Jules Oppert le 20 juin prochain, accompagné d'une exposition à l'Institut des Civilisations. Et Sylvia Laura, en collaboration avec Marco Bonecchi, donnera lors de ce colloque une communication sur Archibald Seyss. Mais pour l'instant, c'est d'études anatoliennes dans les années 30 qu'il sera question à travers la correspondance d'Albrecht Goetze. Ma chère Sylvia, je suis très heureux que tu aies accepté cette invitation et je te donne sans plus tarder la parole.
Merci, merci. Good morning everyone. And I'm very pleased to be here today and honored to be in such a prestigious place. And I would like to thank Professor Dominique Charpin and Professor Thomas Remer for inviting me to present here to you the results of my recent research. And I apologize for not speaking French. So let us start. At the beginning of the 1930s, preclassical Anatolia was still largely terra incognita, although key sites were known from the previous century. I only mention Hisarlik, possibly identified with Homer's Troy, excavated by Heinrich Schliemann, and Boaskei, identified with the Hittite capital Hattusha, thanks to the excavations led by Hugo Winkler at the beginning of the 20th century. And the Winkler excavation, I would like to remember here in this place, had been preceded by the investigation by George Perrault and Ernest Chantre. The outcome of the period of intensive and fertile study on the cuneiform texts found by Winkler at Boaskei was the momentous conference held by Bedrich Rozny in Berlin before the Vorderasiatische Gesellschaft on November 1915, in which he proposed that Hittite was an Indo-European language. The reception of Rodzin's proposal outside Germany was heavily influenced by the First World War. Thus, in Paris, Scheil flatly refused to present to the Académie the result of Rodzin's decipherment of Hittite because he did not wish to publicize the achievements of German science. He wrote, "Pour ne pas avoir l'air de faire de la réclame à la science Bosch." Between 1916 and 1917, nearly all the tablets found in Boas Cay arrived in Berlin. It was therefore possible to work systematically on the publication and the study of Hittite texts, and the remarkable productivity of Hittitological studies in these years is mirrored in the 140 pages of the Bibliographie Hittite, the book published by Georges Contenot in Paris in 1922. Through steady progress had been made during the first two decades of the 20th century, it must be said that Anatolian studies were still in their beginnings. The political event of fundamental importance for the study of ancient Anatolia dates to 1923, when the Republic of Turkey is established with its new capital, Ankara, and with Mustafa Kemal Atatürk elected as its first president. For the next decade or so, the country saw a rapid process of secular westernization through Atatürk's reforms. Historical research and archaeological excavations became a vehicle for the creation of a new national Anatolian Turkish identity. In this context, an Institute for Physical Anthropology was founded in 1925 in order to establish the ethnic foundation of Anatolian history. At the same time, a new impetus was given to archaeology, and foreign excavation projects were particularly welcomed. In this context, it is worth mentioning the massive project by the Chicago Oriental Institute to research the Hittite period in Anatolia. From 1926 onwards, Hans Henning von der Osten and Erich Schmidt led excavations at Alishar Eyuk, making it possible to establish a stratigraphic sequence which was to serve as a benchmark for the whole of Anatolia, and which is still partly valid today. Alisha was one of the first Hittite sites dug in a systematic, scientific manner, and the project was remarkable for its time. The increasing importance of the German-Turkish economic and political ties led to the establishment of the Istanbul Department of the Deutsches Archaeologisches Institut in 1929, the year of the Institute's centenary. Martin Schede served as its first director until 1938. The Institute Istanbul played a central role in the institutionalization of German archaeological research in Turkey, aiming to shed more light on all phases of the cultural history of the host country, the Hittite phase included. In this context, which I have really very briefly outlined, between the late 20s and early 30s, the German philologist Albrecht Goetze was one of the leading scholars of Anatolian studies. And I would like to say here that to label him as a philologist would not do justice to his scholarship. Goetze's interests, knowledge, and competencies covered a much wider field of ancient history. With his books, he laid the foundations for the study of Anatolia. He was the author of the seminal 1928 work Das Hethiter Reich, seine Stellung zwischen Ost und West, and his chapter Kulturgeschichte des Vorgriechischen Kleinasien for the volume of a handbook der Alten Wissenschaft devoted to the Kulturgeschichte des Alten Orient, published in München in 1933. Goetzesky information is summarized in this and in the next slide. In 1931, 34 years old, he was professor of Semitic languages and ancient Oriental history at the Philipps Universität Marburg, having received his PhD from the University of Heidelberg in 1923. In 1933, after the Nazi seizure of power, Goetze left Germany, having been dismissed by the University of Marburg for his political convictions. He was classified as politically unreliable because of his liberal political views and pacifist ideas, even though he was not a member of any pacifist organization. Following visiting appointment in Copenhagen and Oslo, he emigrated to the United States in 1934. He became a professor at Yale University, where he spent the rest of his life. After the war, in fact, Goetze declined an invitation to return to his former position in Marburg. His life and professional career is well documented. Harald Meyer-Metz devoted a book to the story of his life in Germany and of his dismissal from his professorship at Marburg. And Benjamin Foster, among many others, has discussed aspects of Goetze's leading role in American Assyriology. He has been in contact with many scholars, and his correspondence allows us to follow the development of Anatolian studies. His entire correspondence is kept in the Yale University archive, I mean both incoming as well as Goetze's outgoing letters in carbon copy. Goetze's own letters are written mainly in German or in English. After his dismissal from Marburg, he generally preferred to write in English to his German-speaking colleagues. Today, together with you, I would like to browse through Goetze's correspondence from the 30s. Let us start with one of the most intriguing cases, the correspondence with the archaeologist Kurt Bittel. Their scholarly and personal relationship is highlighted by means of their so far unpublished correspondence from the 30s onwards, a wonderful, rich source of information on less known or so far unknown facts. My study of this corpus is in progress, and so today I will present just some preliminary results. In the early 30s, Bittel, as Goetze, was on the upward trajectory of his career. In 1931, 24 years old, he had recently completed his studies in Marburg and was beginning his career as a field archaeologist in Anatolia. That year, thanks in part to the action of Schede, the Turks and Germans, prompted by competition with the Americans, decided that the excavation at Boaz Gay should be resumed by the Deutsches Archaeologisches Institut Istanbul branch and by the Deutsche Orientgesellschaft. Thus, after a long gap, a second period of excavation at Boaz Gay began in 1931. The main goal of these so-called Neue Ausgrabungen was to establish the stratigraphy of the site, and the young prehistorian Bittel was chosen to direct them. When he first arrived in Turkey, before starting his own work at Boğaz Cay, he joined the Alisher excavation team, and this gave him his first experience of a stratigraphic digging method in central Anatolia. The archaeological works in Boğaz Cay were then suspended in 1939, however, because of the outbreak of World War II. Let's now look at the next slide, which shows Bittel's career. In 1933, he was appointed referent at the Archaeologisches Institut des Deutschen Reiches Istanbul, and in 1937, he joined the Nazi Party. In 1938, Bittel succeeded to Schede as first director of the branch of the Istanbul Archaeological Institute. Bittel was also professor at the University of Istanbul from 1942 to 44, and in post-war Germany he was able to carry on his academic career with unbroken continuance. In 1996, he was appointed president of the DAI, and he was professor at the University of Tübingen, Istanbul, and Berlin. And as for Goetze, you can find in this slide some bibliographical references. Despite their so radically different choices, political choices, the two scholars were in contact with each other, and their correspondence provides meaningful insights not only on the different behavior of two non-Jewish scholars in the field of ancient Near Eastern studies with regard to National Socialist regime, but also on their uneasy way of cooperating in the field of Anatolian studies in these momentous years. Goetze and Bittel have been in correspondence since at least 1931. At the center of their exchange of letters in those years was above all the interpretation of the results of the excavation at Alisha and Boğaz Cay, of great interest to Goetze, who was completing his already mentioned chapter Kulturgeschichte der vorgriechischen Kleinasien. Goetze and Bittel met personally in January 1933 in Marburg, as is clear from their correspondence, which also shows their mutual great esteem. Sorry. And here you can see how they refer to their Marburg meeting. There is also a trace of their first meeting in the autobiographical memoir about the years 1930-34 that Bittel wrote in 1945 and that was published posthumously under the title Reisen und Ausgrabungen. Here, Bittel recalls that a very good scientific feeling was established between them, despite the fact that Goetze, portrayed by Bittel as a long-haired pacifist, was so different from him. In any case, Goetze and Bittel would see each other again in person only in September 1951 in Istanbul on the occasion of the 22nd Congress of Orientalists, where the two scholars instigated a lively scientific debate on the latest developments and future prospects of the investigation of preclassical Anatolia. Their intense interaction on this occasion has also left trace in their correspondence. The meeting of 1933 between Goetze and Bittel also left a trace in the correspondence between Goetze and Schede. Kept at Yale again, the latter covers the period from 26 to 33. It reveals the strategic role played by Goetze for the resumption of excavation at Boğaz Cay. Goetze left Germany at the end of 1933. In a letter written from Copenhagen on January 1934, he informed Bittel that he had been dismissed as a consequence of the fourth paragraph of the law for the restoration of a professional civil service, which classified him as politically unreliable, without hiding his concern about the uncertainty of his future. In his letter of reply, written from Istanbul on 11 May 1934, Bittel soberly wrote that he had heard that Goetze would find employment in the United States in the autumn and wished him well. From a much later letter from Goetze to the Hittitologist Hans Gustav Guterbot, written in 1949, we know how very difficult this time was for Goetze and his wife. The correspondence between Goetze and Bittel shows how, a few years later, the question of the omission of bibliographic quotation of Goetze's research. The correspondence between Goetze and Bittel shows how, a few years later, the question of the omission of bibliographical quotation of Goetze's research became a topical issue. Goetze often spoke out against the suppression of scholarly values and freedom of inquiry. To set up the stage, in 1937, Bittel published two important books on Hattusha: Die Kleine Funde, devoted to the finds of the pre-war German excavation, and Die Ruinen von Boaskei, which was the first guidebook of the Hittite capital and therefore was conceived for a large audience. Both were reviewed by Goetze in the American Journal of Archaeology of 1938. Bittel's Die Ruinen was reviewed by many other scholars, as you can see in the slide, including Wolfram von Soden, who published in the Göttingische Gelehrten Anzeigen his Neue Untersuchungen über die Bedeutung der Indogermanen für den Alten Orient, a review article of three books considered important for the understanding of ancient Indo-European. Although recognizing the importance of Bittel's achievements, in his reviews Goetze sharply addressed negative critiques to several statements, interpretations, and choices. Clearly, some of the points of contention fell within the ordinary scientific dialectic, but others can be attributed to ideological reasons. Written after the publication of Goetze's reviews, several long, dense letters dated between the summer of 1938 and the summer of 1939 contain a heated confrontation between the two scholars on this subject, which was also echoed in Goetze's correspondence from those same months with other scholars. For example, Goetze described his confrontation with Bittel to Guterbock in this way: Wir sind uns ein wenig in die Haare geraten. In his letters to Bittel, dated 20 January 1939, explicitly Goetze states that the lack of his works in the bibliography of Bittel's Boaskei guidebook can only be explained for reasons that have nothing to do with science, pointing to the problem with the unhealthy practice of undoing or even cancelling the importance of significant works by authors with different political conviction. What is striking is both the frankness of the close confrontation between the two scholars and the final shared decision triggered by Goetze, as you can see here, to remain in contact despite the evident divergence of opinion. More in general, the controversy between Goetze and Bittel is part of the concern of American scholars in the late 30s with the ideologization of fellow German Orientalists who remained in Germany and were aligned with the regime. The question becomes particularly evident in writings published between 1938 and 45. While some scholars deliberately avoided topics of National Socialist relevance, such as Aryan Hittites, others focused specifically on these research fields. The gulf that divided Goetze and Bittel between 1938 and 39 also involved other issues, and I find one of them particularly interesting. I refer to the Deutsche Orient Gesellschaft, the society which sponsored the Boas Gay excavations from the time before the First World War, and of which Goetze was a member. In a letter dated on 30 July 1939, Goetze emphatically takes the opportunity to inform Bittel of his own resignation from the society membership because of the compliance of the society to the Nazi ideology. And one can note here this statement: Leider gibt es auch andere Gesichtspunkte, die mir in diesem Falle noch gewichtiger zu sein scheinen. Sie rühren an die Grundlagen unserer Existenz überhaupt. So that is, unfortunately, there are also other aspects that seem to me even more important in this case. They touch the foundation of our existence at all. As you see, Goetze had already expressed his doubts to Bittel about the policy of the Deutsche Orient Gesellschaft 2 years before. It was only after May 1938, however, that Goetze decided not to be associated with the DOG any longer. The decision was taken as a consequence of a letter of 25 May 1938 sent by the society to its member, in which the Jews were asked to withdraw from the society. Another significant topic that crops up several times in the correspondence between Goetze and Bittel in this period is the slowness of a publication of the text from Boas Gay, to which Goetze himself had already made a substantial contribution from 1925 onwards. Goetze also publicly expressed his disappointment at the slowness of the publication of the recently discovered cuneiform tablets from Boas Gay, which at Berlin was being handled by Hans Ehelolf. This is shown by Goetze's article devoted to the state of Anatolian and Hittite studies, based on a lecture held just in 1938 at the Haverford Symposium on Archaeology and the Bible, as you can see here in this slide. The recent excavations at Boas Gay had produced a wealth of cuneiform fragmentary tablets. During the first three seasons, 1931 to 33, they were sent to Berlin, while from 34 onwards, they were sent together with the other finds to the Museum of the New Capital, Ankara, recently established in the complex formed by the Mahmud Pasha Bedesteni and the Kurshan Luhan, respectively the Old Bazaar and the Caravanserai of the city. Ehelolf was the official philologist of the expedition, but Guterbock from 33 to 35 served as epigrapher on the field. Actually, since Guterbock, on account of his Jewish heritage on his father's side, was no longer permitted to join the official staff of the excavation at Boas Gay, he could not gain access to the tablets brought to the Archaeological Museum of Ankara. Despite the influence of National Socialism, Bittel succeeded in managing the Boas Gay expedition, permitting Guterbock to continue to cooperate and contribute to the study and publication of epigraphic material. And I will come again on this just in a few minutes. When contact between Goetze and Bittel was interrupted in August 1939, and it would be resumed only in 1949. And I would now like to go deeper into the correspondence, the 30s, between Goetze and Gütersloh. During these years, the fates of Goetze and Gütersloh intersected, not face to face, but through the written word, as is documented by their correspondence, which spans the period from 31 to 1970, until shortly before Goetze's death. Today, it is kept in the Deutsche Nationalbibliothek, Deutsches Exilarchiv at Frankfurt am Main, and again at the Yale University Library Manuscripts and Archives. Both Goetze and Gütersloh often retained carbon copies of the letters they sent to their colleagues, together with those they received, so that in many cases the copies fill in the gaps in the originals, and equally it is not unusual to find the same letter in each of the two archives. The rich epistolary exchange between these two leading German philologists dates mainly to the time of their exile. Gütersloh left Berlin in 1935 for Turkey, where he taught Hittitology at the newly founded University of Ankara, following his Leipzig teacher and close friend Benno Landsberger. After the war, he moved to Chicago, becoming professor at the Oriental Institute. Atatürk, in the framework of his reorganization of the Turkish higher education system, encouraged the inclusion of the newly founded institutions of scholars of various disciplines escaping the Nazi regime. Here, many German scholars who fell foul of Nazi racial laws found a home and position as an alternative to emigrating to America. Because of the central role played by the history of the ancient Anatolian civilization in the Turkish history thesis, which was promoted by the activities of the Turkish Historical Society, the Türk Tarih Kurumu, and the Turkish Language Association, respectively founded in 1931 and 32, scholars of the ancient Near East were made especially welcome. In 1931, Atatürk also supported the foundation of a French Société des études d'Hittite Asianique, providing funding also for its publication, the Revue Hittite Asianique. The Türk Historical Society organized regular congresses and oversaw a prolific publishing system. The Turkish history thesis created an alternative to the existing theory that Greece and or Mesopotamia both were the cradle of Western civilization by claiming instead Hittite ancestry. The thesis insisted on a common racial origin for all Turkish people who had created a great civilization in their Central Asian homeland in prehistoric times and have since retained the same language and racial characteristic. The Turkish history thesis is connected with the Sun language theory published in 1935, which stipulates that all languages have their origin in the Turkish language. Within this framework, new universities in both Istanbul and Ankara were founded, where many foreign scholars, mainly German, who had found their way to Turkey, either because of job opportunity or as refugees from Nazism, as we have already seen, were employed. They created a cosmopolitan cultural and intellectual community, as attested by the reminiscences and the correspondence of both emigre scholars and Turkish students. In 1936, the Faculty of Languages, History and Geography was founded in Ankara, and it was subsequently incorporated in 1946 into the University of Ankara. And there, teaching was instituted in Assyriology, Benno Landsberger, Hittitology, Deuterbock, and Archaeology von der Osten. This faculty, conceived as one of the main centers for the study of ancient cultures of Turkey, was hosted in a new building designed by the German emigre architect Bruno Taut, who made extensive use of references not only to traditional archaeological Anatolian architecture features and motifs, but also to those of Hittite origin. So coming back to the correspondence between Goetze and Deuterbock of these years, more generally, we can say that it highlights a relationship based on deep mutual esteem and frank intellectual dialogue. This is shown by Deuterbock's word in his obituary of Goetze. The main subject of their correspondence deals with the advancement of cuneiform studies. There are often lengthy discussions of problems in the transcriptions, translation, and interpretation of cuneiform texts. And the letters throw light on the extraordinarily stimulating exchange of views on philological matters, reflecting the depth of skills and the breadth of knowledge of both Goetze and Deuterbock. The correspondence also deals with practical aspects of research and teaching, and with publication, conferences, and archaeological expeditions. Further topics of interest are found in the lively, free, and unfettered exchanges of information about the handling of institutional matters and about colleagues, and this mainly in the post-war correspondence. From this point on, I would like just to offer some more precise insight into the Goetze-Deuterbock correspondence of the 30s. A major role is played by the interpretation of extraordinary finds from the excavations at Gezlikule Ancient Tarsus in Cilicia, conducted by Hetty Goldman and sponsored jointly by Bryn Mawr College, the Archaeological Institute of America, and the Folk Museum of Harvard University. The Goetze-Deuterbock discussions mainly deals with a controversial dating of a Hittite lens-deed tablet known as Tarsus I, discovered by Goldman in a sealed refuse pit together with a bulla exhibiting the seal of the Hittite queen Puduhepa. And the result, this is interesting because the result of this collaboration led to various publications by Goetze in which the importance of Deuterbock's contribution is evident. So these letters are, in a way, the backstage of the publication. In the Goetze-Deuterbock correspondence, mirrors the situation of the Turkish archaeological excavations. In parallel with the foreign excavations at many prominent sites, Atatürk contributed to the development of the first Turkish excavations. The Turkish society mapped hundreds of potential archaeological sites which were designated for future digs. The excavations conducted at Alaja Eyyub by Hamid Subehir Koshay between 1935 and 1937 were the most significant accomplishment among the Turk Tarik Kurumu project. Their results played a major role during the International Second Congress of the Turkish Historical Society, held in Istanbul at the Dolmabahçe Palace in 1937. In the framework of this conference, a great exhibition was organized aimed to present material evidence for the Turkish history thesis, also including archaeological finds from both Alaja and Boaskey. And this event played a major role in the press. And this is the entrance of the exhibition. The importance of this conference was affirmed by the issue of commemorative postage stamps, which also featured Hittite antiquities, as would also happen in later years on different occasions. So, and you can see here a bronze standard found in the excavation in Alaja, and it was chosen as something like a symbol of the excavation and a symbol of the archaeological activity of this period. And so you can see it here in the postage seal and then in this famous monument in Ankara. Another topic of the Getse-Guterbock correspondence in this period is, of course, the excavations at Boaskey. Guterbock, in addition to his teaching, continued to devote himself in Turkey to studying the cuneiform texts from Hattusha. As his restrictions did not apply to the texts found in the excavations directed by Hugo Winkler at the beginning of the 20th century, which were kept in the Museum of Istanbul, Guterbock dedicated himself to publishing those texts that remains as yet unpublished. On several occasions, the Getse-Guterbock correspondence documents Getse's disapproval of a restriction imposed on Guterbock. Interestingly, in the same year, 1938, Guterbock wrote to Getse that Bittel was unable to do anything, though he also disliked the situation. Guterbock worked in Istanbul with his own and Landsberger scholars, including Muazzez Cech, who died in 25 at the age of 110 years. In the framework of a strong international network, Turkish scholars were in fact involved and cooperated in German projects. In 1935, the Boaskey excavations team included Halet Şambel and Sedat Alp, while Muazzez Çig and Hatice Bozkurt, together with Guterbock, dedicated themselves to copying and publishing the cuneiform text from Boaskey of the museum in Istanbul. And I only mention that Atatürk exhorted Turkish experts to receive training abroad, and Sedat Alp was the first scholar trained in Hittitology who was sent off to Germany, first in Leipzig and then in Berlin. Therefore, the letters written by Guterbock document in particular two aspects of modern history that are little studied and almost which, moreover, few sources are available. Firstly, Turkey and its socio-political and educational history, particularly the rise of cuneiform studies as an academic specialization in the country, and secondly, German exiles living in Ankara. Many insights on the situation of the 30s in Turkey and the management of the Anatolian studies are also contained in the Getse-Guterbock correspondence of the 40s. After the interruption in the correspondence between the two scholars caused by the Second World War, the long letter from Guterbock to Getse, dated 22 February 1946, Together with Goetz's reply, dated 29 April of the same year, marked the re-establishment of their epistolary contact. The beginning of 1946 was a time of general widespread resumption of contacts between scholars who exchanged news about their own fortunes and circumstances and those of their colleagues. Much information about the tense and dynamic post-war years can be gleaned from the written correspondence between the scholars of the ancient Near East, which often remains unpublished. And the correspondence between Goetze and Guterbock is a very telling example of this. The already mentioned Guterbock's letters to Goetze contains a detailed update on his scientific activity and the publications resulting from it. One is struck by the richness of information on the gestation of new works, not only his own, but also those of colleagues. However, philological research is not the only topic Guterbock deals with. He also discusses the planned foundation of a French institute at Ankara, together with the resumption of the excavation at Arslantepe and the progress of the construction of a new archaeological museum, and asks about the fate of the Berlin Museum and its cuneiform tablets. The letter is also punctuated by sober but dramatic reports of what became of many colleagues. So, we found read in this letter, in this point, of the sad fates of, among others, the elderly Louis Delaporte and the young Leonid Zuntz. At the beginning of the Nazi period, the young Jewish philologist Leonid Zuntz left Germany, settling in England in 1934 as a refugee scholar at Somerville College at Oxford. Zuntz's premature death in 1942 was regarded by Guterbock as Goetze as a great loss to Hittite, more general Anatolian studies. Her unpublished lexicographical notes and cards on Hittite vocabulary, now kept in the manuscripts collections of Griffith Institute Archive, Oxford, testify to the huge scale of her work on the subject. The Yale archives also keep the correspondence of the 30s between Goetze and Zuntz. So finally, I would like to conclude by observing that the correspondence between Goetze and Guterbock of the 40s explicitly addresses the reflection on the involvement of colleagues with National Socialism. It sheds light on the relationships between the Germans exiled in Turkey and those who worked there while maintaining close contacts with the German institutions. Indeed, Nazi Germany sought to maintain its long-standing links with Turkey. The situations of the scholars aligned with the Nazi regime were very varied, however, and sometimes rather ambiguous, as this extraordinary Guterbock's letter dated 11 May 1946 show particularly. And this passage refers to the peculiar situation of Bittel himself. So 3 years before resuming contact with Bittel, Goetze had asked Guterbock if Bittel had been a Nazi. Guterbock had answered he was not. His answer to Goetze faces with a thorny problem of assessing and evaluating the involvement of scholars of ancient Near Eastern studies in Nazism that is more complicated than simply determining their party membership. Of course, the key problem of a passive membership stance raises questions about complicity and collective responsibility, as well as the hot question of the very existence of a unpolitische Wissenschaft. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.